This is the last day of this December 2012 four-day Sesshin, and it is the eighth day of the 12th month. This is the day when the Japanese most of the rest of most of the Western world recognizes as the day of the Buddha's enlightenment. And I found myself heart humble and grateful this morning, with feeling especially reverent toward the Buddha for this Dharma. And I'm going to make this teisho about the Buddha, not about his enlightenment experience. That's something that we will give full treatment to in 3 days when we have our annual Buddha's enlightenment ceremony. But instead, trying to offer a sense of the Buddha as a man, as a person. And with that, we have to get into the way in which he was a product of his time, his era. I'm going to be reading from this marvelous biography of the Buddha by Karen Armstrong. The title is simply Buddha. Just a beautifully written account. It became, I see, a New York Times bestseller. I read it last February when I was in New Zealand for Amala Sensei's Dharma transmission ceremony, and I can't recommend it highly enough to others. You'll get a taste of it this morning. Of course, I can only just pluck out a few paragraphs to read from. It's a full book. And in the introduction, she begins by talking about the difficulty of coming up with a biography of the Buddha. And I'll read this paragraph. The Gospels present Jesus, for example, as a distinct personality with idiosyncrasies, special turns of phrase, moments of profound emotion and struggle, irascibility and terror have been preserved. This is not true of the Buddha, who is presented as a type rather than as an individual. In his discourses, we find none of the sudden quips, thrusts, and witticisms that delight us in the speech of Jesus or Socrates. He speaks as the Indian philosophical tradition demands, solemnly, formally, and impersonally. After his enlightenment, we get no sense of his likes and dislikes, his hopes and fears, moments of desperation, elation, or intense striving. What remains is an impression of a transhuman serenity, self-control, a nobility that has gone beyond the superficiality of personal preference, and a profound equanimity. The Buddha is often compared to non-human beings, to animals, trees, or plants, not because he is subhuman or inhumane, but because he has utterly transcended the selfishness that most of us regard as inseparable from our condition. The Buddha was trying to find a new way of being human. And aren't we all, as we sit here in Sesshin, aren't we all who are practicing Zen? She goes on, in the West, we prize individualism and self-expression, but this can easily degenerate into mere self-promotion. What we find in Gotama is a complete and breathtaking self-abandonment. he would not have been surprised to learn that the sutras do not present him as a fully rounded personality, the word personality is in quotation marks, but would have said that our concept of personality was a dangerous delusion. So, this is me speaking now. So, whereas we don't have much about, specifically about the Buddha as a person, we have, she weaves together a wonderful sense of how he must have been a product of his era, his age, that I, for me, really helped get a better sense of Buddha, the person. She just winds up here by saying the sutras were not interested in tracing Gotama's unique personal achievements, but in setting forth the path that all Buddhas, all human beings, must take when they seek enlightenment. Still in the introduction now, she says that, talks about the particularly American optimism of looking on the bright side of everything. And then she says the Buddha would have had little time for this. In his view, the spiritual life cannot begin until people allow themselves to be invaded by the reality of suffering, realize how fully it permeates our whole experience, and feel the pain of all other beings, even those whom we do not find congenial. And that's why this, by suffering, what's usually translated as suffering, dukkha, or dissatisfaction, frustration, is the first of the Four Noble Truths. This is the beginning of change when we feel dissatisfied. We're looking for something more, not just some other form of worldly fulfillment, but something beyond the worldly. To reach this state means that in some sense, maybe some inchoate sense, we already realize that worldly success and pleasure and gratification and so forth can only take us so far, that it is ultimately hollow, because we're going to all die someday. I think that bumper sticker that was around, you'd see around 10 years ago or so, really was getting at this. It was really kind of a Buddhistic ethos to it, where it said, the one who has the most things when he dies wins. I think it also, to really come to terms with this matter of the all-pervasiveness of suffering, of dissatisfaction, is to see that it is inseparable from self-centeredness, that so long as we have a self-centered orientation to life, we will be left wanting. She sets up this straw man where she says, we assume that a person like the Buddha will become inhuman, humorless, and grim. Yet that does not seem to have been true of the Buddha. He may have been impersonal, but the state he achieved inspired an extraordinary emotion in all who met him. And then she mentions some of the qualities that we can read about the most, the constant, even relentless degree of gentleness, fairness, equanimity, and impartiality and serenity acquired by the Buddha touch a chord and resonate with some of our deepest yearnings. People were not repelled by his dispassionate calm, not daunted by his lack of preference for one thing, one person over another. Instead, they were drawn to the Buddha and flocked to him. I suppose you could raise the question of whether contemporary people, Americans anyway, would still have this, feel so drawn to someone like the Buddha. Quite possibly, yes. There probably was a quality that the Buddha radiated that would inspire almost anyone. But even in the texts that come from his time, we hear about those who were not inspired by him, who had problems with him. But they seem to have been very, very few. She writes here that he was a haven of peace in a violent world of clamorous egotism. Mentions the world-turning decision of Siddhartha Gautama to leave the palace and go out into the life of homelessness and the quest for enlightenment. She mentions that when he looked at human life, he could only see a grim cycle of suffering which began with the trauma of birth and proceeded inexorably to aging, illness, death, sorrow, and corruption. He himself was no exception to this universal rule. At present, he was young, healthy, and handsome, but whenever he reflected on the suffering that lay ahead, all the joy and confidence of youth drained out of him. I mentioned earlier, a couple days ago, in the Teisho, about those fortunate ones, young people who can imagine, can foresee this happening, as it, of course, will. Looking for a description here of him in his old age, and I can't find it, but it was quite moving to me to read this, because we don't hear about this generally in the old texts, about how unsteady he was in his old age, and even bent over. We always, of course, see the Buddha with this magnificent posture. But it wasn't always that way. He too became an old man, and was stooped and frail, shriveled to some degree. Well, he knew that would be coming if he lived long enough. Uh, It says that Gotama had become disenchanted with domestic life in an ordinary Indian household, but he had not lost hope in life itself, far from it. He was convinced that there was a solution to the puzzle of existence and that he could find it. He may have been the original Guy Noir, one man continuing to seek the answers to life's persistent questions. It says he subscribed to what has been called the perennial philosophy because it was common to all people and all cultures in the pre-modern world. Earthly life was obviously fragile and overshadowed by death, but it did not constitute the whole of reality. Everything in the mundane world had, it was thought, its more powerful, positive replica in the divine realm. So that was news to me. That's what is meant by the perennial philosophy. This cannot be all there is. There must be something better, fuller, and more satisfying elsewhere. And so the Buddha reasoned that just as there was, if there was death, aging, illness, birth, sorrow, and corruption, these suffering states must have their positive counterparts. There must be another mode of existence, and it was up to him to find it. And then she introduces us to the concept of Nibbana, which a literal translation of which means blowing out. It relates to the possibility of extinguishing the blind passions, or we say uprooting the blind passions, but the choice of the word Nibbana comes from the root word to cool. It's similar to the cooling we experience after we recover from a fever. In Gotama's time, the word Nibbuta was a term in daily use to describe a convalescent. So Gotama was leaving home to find a cure for the sickness that plagues humanity. He believed that he could find the freedom he sought right in the midst of this imperfect world. Instead of waiting for a message from the gods, he would search within himself for the answer, explore the furthest reaches of his mind, and exploit all his physical resources. Well, that somewhat describes this effort that we call sesshin, exploring the furthest reaches of the mind, using all of our physical resources. In his age, there was just widespread acceptance of the existence of the gods, plural. It says that here that Gotama believed that gods existed, but was not much interested in them. And he felt that he could not expect help from the gods. At this time, this was the 6th century BCE, 6th century before Christ, the gods, the deities, had begun to recede from the religious consciousness of the most thoughtful people. They were not exactly regarded as worthless, but they had become unsatisfactory as objects of worship. More and more men and women decided that they must rely entirely on themselves. This was a big change. They couldn't rely on the gods. They had to look to themselves for liberation. At the time, rebirth was just as widely accepted, more so, as the belief in the gods. And she said that what preoccupied Gotama and his contemporaries was not so much the possibility of rebirth as the horror of re-death. This is another element of fuel for spiritual practice, Zen practice. it's not, I think it's not common, but for those who can imagine what it's like to not just be reborn again and again and again and again and again and again, and again, but to die, to go through the deterioration and the pain and suffering and of dying again and again and again. Worse, the suffering of again and again going through adolescence. So she points out that Westerners often describe Indian thought as negative and nihilistic, but no, she says, it was breathtakingly optimistic, and Gotama shared this hope to the full. Then she describes the more about his age, his era. The Ganges region where he had gone was a spiritual crisis, the sort of disillusion and enemy that Gotama had experienced was widespread, and people were desperately aware that they needed a new religious solution. The monk was thus engaged in a quest that would benefit his fellows, often at huge cost to himself. Gotama is often described in heroic imagery, suggesting strength, energy, and mastery. This age of his has been called, some historians call it the Axial Age. This was between 800 BC and 200 BC. He himself was born in 563, usually they say. It was the age of Confucius and Lao Tzu, and also Socrates and Plato. And she says the Axial Age marks the beginning of humanity as we know it. It was during this period that men and women became conscious of their existence, their own nature, and their limitations in an unprecedented way. David Abram outlines this brilliantly in his book, The Spell of the Sensuous. It's quite eye-opening to realize that there was a time when the self, as we know it, was not understood. I mean, people did not understand themselves as having individual existence apart from others. They saw themselves much more as embedded in this world of the gods and forces beyond their control. The pendulum may have to swing back more in that direction, because we've gone to such an extreme of delusion and thinking that this individual self has control over his or her environment. I think it's starting to emerge now, where there's so much research, so many books reporting on research about what is beyond our conscious control. It was during this period that Taoism and Confucianism emerged in China, and of course Buddhism and Hinduism in India. And then she lapses into a reflective period here of wondering why it was that only the Chinese, the Indians, the Iranians, the Jews, and the Greeks experienced these new horizons and embarked on the quest for enlightenment and salvation, unlike the Babylonians and the Egyptians. a little more about the Axial Age, what happened in the Axial countries. There was this conviction that the world was awry. That's a great word for dukkha. The people of these Axial countries were consumed by a sense of helplessness. They were obsessed by their mortality and felt a profound terror of and alienation from the world. In China, Confucius lamented the darkness of his age. In India, the world had become a frightening place. The Buddhist sutras speak of the terror, awe, and dread that people experienced when they ventured outside the city and went into the woods. Nature had become obscurely menacing, rather as it had become inimical to Adam and Eve after their lapse. Gotama did not leave home to commune happily with nature in the woods, but experienced a continuous fear and horror. If a deer approached, or if the wind rustled in the leaves, he recalled later, his hair stood on end. It seems that in our age, more and more people are going to extremes of extreme sports and other risk-taking, wildly reckless risk-taking behavior in order to feel alive, I think. I think that's part of it. And also to test themselves and to face their fears. She looks at some other historical forces that why the experience of suffering reached such a crescendo in the axial regions of India and China and Greece and so forth. She mentions the invasions of the nomadic Indo-European horsemen as a common factor in all these areas. These were the Aryan tribesmen coming storming out of Central Asia and reaching the Mediterranean. This Aryan Aryan India was static and conservative. There were the caste system, the Brahmins and the others, and they became hereditary, these caste systems. You couldn't break out of them. And this is one of the great distinctions of the Buddha, is he rejected caste divisions. He was widely criticized by others at the time for his rejection of such something so fundamental to Indian society and culture. The Aryan spirituality was typical of the ancient pre-axial religions, which were based on acceptance of the status quo, and they involved little speculative thought about the meaning of life, and saw sacred truth as something that was given and unchangeable. It wasn't sought after, but passively received. You see the contrast in why the Buddha came to be regarded as such a revolutionary. Then Socrates, like the Buddha, questioned everything. I think I quoted him earlier this week, where he said, "Wisdom begins in wonder." But this axial faith put the onus on the individual. Wherever they looked, the axial sages and prophets saw exile, tragedy, and dukkha. The new religion sought inner depth rather than magical control. The sages were no longer content with external conformity, but were aware of the profound psychic inwardness that precedes action. Crucial was the desire to bring unconscious forces and dimly perceived truths into the light of day. And this is interesting. Instead of hugging a secret truth to themselves, as the Brahmins had done, the axial sages sought to publish it abroad. I couldn't help but think of this revolutionary change in this information age where publishing is no longer the exclusive prerogative of publishing houses and journalists, but everything has been split open. And then she talks about how also another major factor that led to these axial sages like the Buddha and Socrates and Confucius and Lao Tzu was a new urban class coming into being. And this brought merchants from all over India and all castes mingling in the marketplace and this discussion of new philosophical ideas. In the new economic climate, people in the cities wanted to concentrate on karma, which would yield a sounder investment. I never thought of it as an investment, but I guess it is the ultimate investment. There's so much I'm skipping, believe it or not. So there's a widespread growing rejection, a spiritual rejection of the ancient Aryan traditions toward a more practical turn. People were less interested in metaphysical speculation about the nature of ultimate reality and more concerned with personal liberation. You see how the Buddha would so naturally have arisen out of such a time. And so in this milieu, the homeless monk, had become a person who had literally walked out of Aryan society. In leaving home, Gotama was not abjuring the modern world for a more traditional or even archaic lifestyle, as monks are often perceived to be doing today, but he was in the vanguard of change. Who knows? The monks today may be in that same vanguard of change, although they're widely considered to be way back and stuck in ancient times. So the story of the Buddha's quest, she says, is almost a paradigm of axial age spirituality. It shows how a human being becomes fully conscious. Fully conscious of his or her predicament. She talks about the Buddha seeing these three sights of sickness, old age, and death. And she says that he had permitted the spectacle of dukkha to invade his life and to tear his world apart. He had smashed the hard carapace in which so many of us encase ourselves in order to keep sorrow at a distance. Well, coming to Sesshin, of course, especially coming to multiple Sesshins, is another way of smashing this shell, or if not smashing it, dissolving it little by little. We can't maintain our denial of pain and suffering through over the course of many Sesshins. We can't maintain this illusion of self and other over the course of many Sesshins. We come to see that we are not enclosed in a shell, that we are rather intertwined with all beings. We are interdependent. Just as the Gotama was about to set off on his quest for enlightenment, she writes that Mara, the lord of the world of death, the world of ego, erupted threateningly before him. "Don't become a monk. Don't renounce the world," Mara begged, because this would mean unseating the ego and its domination of the mind. It said that even after the Buddha's great enlightenment, Mara is sort of the Buddhist version of Satan. Mara followed Gotama around like an ever-present shadow to trap him in a moment of weakness. Long after Gotama had attained the supreme enlightenment, he still had to be on his guard against Mara. This speaks right to what we've heard so many times, is the force of habit energy. This, even after awakening, the wind ceases, but the waves still surge. Certainly, if that's true after the supreme perfect enlightenment of the Buddha, how much more so are we susceptible to it before then? For example, after a sesshin, after emerging from a sesshin, we can feel so elevated, so buoyant and clear about our conduct and how we have to respect the consequences of our actions and our words and everything. But then there is this shadow that we have to respect. We are all still vulnerable to this tremendous force, this momentum of self-centeredness, this momentum of dividing the world into self and other, into the I, the me, and the mine. She talks about the great draw of yoga in the time of the Buddha. She says that the word yoga, the root word, comes from to yoke or to bind together. That, by the way, that's the same with the word religion. Religion comes from the root word religare, which means the same thing, to bind together. And its goal was to link the mind of the yogin with his true self and to tether all the powers and impulses of the mind so that consciousness becomes unified in a way that is normally impossible for human beings. Well, this is what we're doing. He's talking about samadhi. Yoga, she says, was thus deeply in line with the axial age ethos, its attempt to make human beings more fully conscious of themselves. She points out that those who practice yoga in America and Europe today do not always have this objective. They just have often used the disciplines of yoga to improve their health. I think maybe even more common goal for people who practice in the zillions of yoga studios today is just to become more slender. She says that certainly the yogic exercises can enhance our control and induce a serenity, but the original yogins did not embark on this path in order to feel better and to live a more normal life. They wanted to abolish normality and wipe out their mundane selves. It's even worse than she says here, because from what I've read, a big element in the great yoga craze that we see now is the gear, the stuff, the clothes, and all the trappings. It's interesting that Vipassana Buddhist centers in this country, they refer to practitioners as yogis, at least some that I've heard. That suggests the broader understanding of yoga as this body-mind discipline, which enables us to transcend the self. Yogins believe that the self could only be liberated if they destroyed their normal thought processes, extinguished their thoughts and feelings, and wiped out the unconscious vasanas, that's unconscious forces, that fought against enlightenment. They were engaged in a war against their conventional mental habits. At each point of his interior journey, the yogin did the opposite of what came naturally. Each yogic discipline was crafted to undermine ordinary responses. So we see some of this in Sesshin. We see the importance of keeping the eyes down, maintaining silence, not getting into socializing, all for the purpose of transcending our reflexive impulses. Well, I'll just wrap this up with an appreciation of what the Buddha accomplished. Just to say it's amazing means nothing, actually. It's look at what we have available to us. A method to use the mind in a way that will free us, open us, clear us, empty us of all of the impediments to seeing things as they are. I think in a very real sense, anyone who practices Zen seriously is a revolutionary. It is the ultimate revolution in which we are subverting the dominant paradigm. The dominant paradigm being I, me, and my. But we have to keep at it. The Buddha, I read somewhere else, he said there are two mistakes in practice. One is not starting, and the other is quitting. Sesshin has great value inasmuch as it can give us the momentum, and momentum that grows out of faith. The faith, the experience of Sesshin, the faith to keep going through thick and thin, through in the face of the discouragement, the doubts, the all of the hindrances that face us just as much as they did Siddhartha. Our time is up. We'll stop now and recite the four vows.